It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Food Friday, we'll talk to a Wisconsin farmer about edible flowers and how to use them in your cooking. First, a new project explores the history of Black and Indigenous land dispossession mapped across two states, New York and Wisconsin. In 1850, half of Wisconsinites were born in New York, a reflection of the large numbers of farmers, both Black and white, who came to Wisconsin seeking to profit off the wheat boom. There were also a large number of Indigenous people who had been forced to leave New York and resettle in Wisconsin. The Whose Land Project, which recently was granted a Whiting Award, takes this historical connection and brings it to the present day by talking to people who are on the land now and figuring out how'd they get there, who was on the land originally, and why did they leave. James Levy is an associate professor of history specializing in race and ethnic studies and a public historian at UW-Whitewater. He's the founder and director of the Wisconsin Farms Oral History Project. His project, Whose Land, explores the parallel histories of 19th century New York and Wisconsin. James, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
There's a lot of pieces to this story. I want to start back in that staggering number in 1850 and meet some of the people who came here to Wisconsin from New York, starting with Native Americans who had been dispossessed there and came here. Can you tell us a little of that story?
Yeah, well, it definitely does start with the indigenous stories. And in Oneida County, New York, we have the Brothertown, we have Oneida, obviously. Different bands of indigenous groups had actually come together and already been dispossessed in parts of New England and ended up in Oneida County, New York in the 1820s and 1830s. Were basically forcibly removed, most of them, to Wisconsin. Some went into Canada. And it was on Menominee land, some Ho-Chunk land. But that story, right, this whole project is about questioning what, you know, displacement and even asking questions like what is ancestral land? And so you have a story of indigenous groups who came over who are ancestral indigenous to this country but are on other land. So there's all these layers we're playing with. You fast forward a little bit into the 1840s and 1850s, and you have this huge migration, as you did in your intro, from, well, New England in general, we call them Yankee Yorkers, but or the East Coast, I should say. But New York was incredibly the main feeder of that. And one of the things that we want to explore in this project also is how many of those people coming from New York were African-American? Because we know that throughout central New York, which is where we're looking in rural New York, you know, places around Syracuse, the basically the Finger Lakes area, there were lots of Black farming communities there, as there were in Wisconsin. And we know that abolitionism comes over from New York and the East Coast into Wisconsin these years. So we're trying to explore who among those people, who these people really were who came over from New York to Wisconsin in the mid-19th century.
That's a capsule view of what's going on in the mid-19th century. Let's fast forward today now. You've been collecting stories already, oral history stories from Wisconsin farms. What are you doing in Whose Land to connect that story from the 1800s with who lives on the land now?
Well, we really want to know about the legacies of who has been on the land and who got pushed off the land, right? So like going back to those 19th century free Black farming communities, some scholars estimate as many as 30 to 35 free Black farming communities in Wisconsin alone, almost all of them are completely gone now. And so what we want to find out is, as they have been replaced, who is there now? So we go to these sites. We have to investigate exactly where they were. So that's a bit of archival and deeds research. And we find out who's on the land, how they got there. We explore their family histories. But as we do the land research, we also find out who used to be on the land, whether it's in, you know, 1870 or 1920. And then we do some genealogy work and we trace people who may now be living in Miami, Florida or wherever, and ask them, you know, do oral histories with them, track down family archives, photographs and things like that, and really try to eventually engage them in conversations with each other. This whole project is going to culminate in a podcast. And part of the idea is the dialogue part of it, this sort of public conversations about race, and in our case, about land and farming, bringing people together who have been on the same land at different points in time. Ultimately, we hope, with the goal to support land reparations, reconciliation projects. You know, our project just brings public humanities to the table and history. But really, we want to situate ourselves that we're supporting this incredible work going on by BIPOC farmers in New York, in Wisconsin, who are in cooperatives and collectives reclaiming the land. And you'll hear from the two guests, I guess, later can talk more directly to that. These are ongoing stories to the present for sure.
Talking to James Levy, Associate Professor of History at UW-Whitewater, about his Whose Land Project, his and a lot of collaborators on this, looking at the history of who lived where in Wisconsin and stories of people, Native Americans and black farmers in particular, who were moved onto land or moved onto the land themselves and then dispossessed of it again in many cases. And James, I've talked to other historians about, okay, when we think of Native American relocation, we might think of the Southeast to Oklahoma story. When we talk about black farmers, we don't necessarily think about the Midwest. Can you talk about how these stories have been forgotten, erased in our memory here in the Midwest?
Well, I think it's as simple as saying who's there now, and one of the things about erasure on land in memory is that we don't have the institutions to hold this memory, right? So if you think about what creates a historical society as one example, people who are invested in their own history in a local area will collect the histories often of the, quote unquote, first families who are defined by who's there now and maybe also by who's had, traditional ideas of success and things like that. If you go to some places, anyone who knows Wisconsin, the black history in Wisconsin in rural areas may have heard of Cheyenne Valley or Pleasant Ridge, which are two communities that were down in the southwest, Driftless area. There's a couple gravestones left in what used to be thriving communities of hundreds of people. So the Grant County Historical Society has an amazing collection as one example, but we don't have the living memory helping to preserve that. And their collection, is nothing compared to, other local historical societies, which are remembering families that are still there. So erasure works in that way. And I think one of the things we're exploring is how does memory and, sort of historical erasure and physical displacement, how do those things interact? We don't know yet. We're sort of just beginning this project in terms of research, but we can look at dates, on the calendar when we see that if you look at the black population as one example in counties throughout Wisconsin, we see that in 1910 census and 1920 census, usually in that range, the population starts to dip, where it had been growing all the way through the late 19th, early 20th century, even if the numbers are small in those rural areas. Something is going on which is linked to what's happening nationally with the rise of the Ku Klux Klan again in the teens and 20s, with urbanization. We want to find out exactly what's going on and how these communities end up being dispersed. Or frankly, pushed out through racism.
As you mentioned, in a few minutes, we're going to talk to a couple of the partners in some of the work that you're doing. Are you looking to hear from people? If somebody's listening now saying, I have a story from my family, whether we're still on that land or I know we used to be, are there ways for people to participate in this?
Oh, absolutely. And I appreciate you asking that. For sure. And I should also say that, while this project foregrounds Black and Indigenous voices, it's very much looking at all people who have touched these lands, white farmers, but also we have a strong history here of Hmong farmers, of, Hispanic farmers, also people who are farm workers. So anyone who is invested in farming or has family history in the state and, in Wisconsin and New York, we absolutely would love to hear from. Did you want me to give out a website or?
Oh, if you'd like to, sure. If you've got one ready to rock.
Yeah, I'm ready to rock with people. Anyone can write me. I have a very simple email. It's my last name and my first initial, Levy J, LEVYJ. And then it's at uww.edu, which is University of Wisconsin Whitewater, uww.edu. So, we'd love to hear. We have a website from the past project that this grew out of called Lands We Share. And you can learn that was a traveling exhibit we did 2 years ago, dealing with some similar themes just in Wisconsin. And that's landsweshare, all one word, .org. And you can sign up for a newsletter there or learn about the past project.
Can you talk about the value of oral history? Because I think a lot of people might think of history, as the documents and images and things like that. What kind of things can we get from oral history?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And that's at the heart of what we do. And so oral history itself is going to give you memory and people's firsthand encounters with history in a way that a lot of documents don't give us. Obviously, it's a dialogue, so the historian gets to ask the questions and direct, you know, where it's going in a way that we can't with a letter we find. But what I also think about oral history is that it's, you know, as people say, it's sort of bottom-up history. I'm not sure I love the hierarchy of how that's framed, but you know, we're getting stories that aren't usually preserved for all the reasons I was saying before. So what we get to do is we get to go and find people and interview them about their stories wherever they're living now. But in the process, there's another thing about oral history, which I think is incredibly powerful. And that is that it's this incredible moment of bonding between two people. Sharing stories is kind of the heart of the human existence and experience. And when you do that with someone, you bond with them and you form these relationships, which in turn get to what this project is also about, which is collaboration, right? We don't see ourselves as scholars or students studying history or people. We see ourselves as partnering with people to make stories, to produce, you know, narratives and reproduce and change the narrative through this process. So even if we start with an oral history and we end up with documents, sometimes that process is really powerful. We start with a person, and then in talking to them, we now have a relationship, and they can maybe point us to their great aunt who might have the family photographs, right, or the family histories.
We're talking to James Levy right now, Associate Professor of Race and Ethnic Studies and Director of the Public History Program at UW-Whitewater. He oversees the Wisconsin Farms Oral History Project. He's with us to talk about the Whose Land Project that will look at land dispossession among Black and Indigenous communities in New York and Wisconsin, and a big connection between those two states, ours and New York, in the 1800s. Coming up in just a bit, we'll be hearing from a couple of partners in the project, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the project? Maybe a story to share about the land you live on or that your family used to live on. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with UW-Whitewater historian James Levy about the Whose Land Project, which explores dispossession of Black and Indigenous land in Wisconsin and New York. We have two of the people who are helping make the Whose Land Project happen here with us now to talk about land dispossession in their own communities' histories. Donnell Cross is Executive Director of Metcalf Park Community Bridges in Milwaukee. Donnell, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And Neil Patterson is Assistant Director for the Center for Native Peoples and the Environment at the State University of New York College of Environmental Science and Forestry. Neil, thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Donnell, can you start us off by telling us your involvement with the Whose Land Project, including the stories of people in Milwaukee?
Well, me and James had did another project a couple of years ago around food and growing food in communities. And the projects were so successful, and the community really appreciated being able to be heard and to tell their stories, that when James came to me with this project, it was right on time, because this is what our organization is focusing on, which is displacement, and especially with the impact of COVID-19.
And Neil, how did you first get involved with the project?
Well, so my family are longtime heritage corn growers, and we have a special connection between Tuscarora, where I was raised, and Oneida, our Oneida brothers and sisters out in the western Great Lakes. And through a mutual friend, I heard about the stories that James was collecting, and it really overlaps with a lot of the work the center does in terms of thinking about stories of land. And as Gary Nabham calls it, the restoration of land, as well as restoration of land, too.
Donnell, you mentioned that you have done food, community food production in the Milwaukee area, and we know that James is looking at the stories of Black farmers in the early days of Wisconsin. Do you see connections between that older history and some of the work you're doing today?
I definitely do. And with the work that me and James is going to be doing together, I think this is a really good project to help educate other people about the fact that communities like ours can be self-sustaining, used to be self-sustaining, and the government sanctioned displacement of our people have really kind of collapsed some of those internal structures that we've had. And so our community just want to get back to that. And in order to do that, we have to not only build our capacity, but build the state's and the city's capacity to understand that they need to support keeping people in place, keeping people in place.
And how, Danielle, do you see, what's the priority? How do we do that?
Well, just, you know, one of the things, and I don't want to say just do, because it's not an easy thing, but when we talk about equity, we need to put equity in the front of our thinking, and I think that's a hard job when you've never done it before. So, like, when you think about development, look at those small community organizations that's doing development in their own community. Community land trust, giving to the community authority over its land is one way to think about it. It's not something that we've been doing, but it's something we need to think about doing. We need to think about doing it in a totally different way from what we've been doing.
And Neil, you work in a department that handles, among other things, environmental issues. How do you see the Whose Land Project providing connections, a new lens to the way we think about the environment?
Well, typically folks, you know, have in their mind an idea of what is agriculture and even what is land, right? And so, you know, growing up in a Haudenosaunee community, whose ceremonies and way of life are still tied to the land, we recognize that there are more than human relatives that we share the land with. And they are an intimate and integral part of the way we produce food on the land as well. And so it's a much different lens than, you know, Western science typically looks through at history, at science, at the humanities. And so we're trying to think about those maple trees that we share in common with our brothers and sisters in Oneida, Wisconsin, as well as here in the Finger Lakes and Central New York region. We think about all of those plants, those animals, those rivers, those lakes that have standing in our worldview. And it's important for us to recognize that, we are connected through those cultural roots, no matter how far apart we are.
Before we bring James Levy back, and I want to ask each of you what you're hoping the public takes away from this and starts thinking about when it comes to land dispossession. And Neil, let's start with you on that.
Well, for Oneida and Tuscarora, where I come from, it's a unique situation because, you know, we had allied ourselves with the United States during the American Revolution and actually were promised by the U.S. government to have our land secured after the revolution. And Oneida faced one of the most severe acts of dispossession that I can think of. In the Confederacy, 5.5 million acres down to 32 acres is what I remember growing up here in Central New York, that all of the entire Oneida Indian Nation had to live on by 1900 or so. So, you know, I think it is about equity. It's about justice. It's about telling a different story and really thinking about what can be done to make it right. What are the programs in place that protect and conserve not only the ecological resources that are on land, but also the cultural for us? And so we're involved in programs in reclaiming and what we would say rematriating land, giving it back its rightful place in our lives as Haudenosaunee people.
And Danielle, what are you hoping people come away from this conversation thinking about?
I'm just in total agreement. I think it's the same thing that people learn from this history, and then we start a conversation of how we do things different. One of the things for Black people is that we have had our land taken by brute force or taken systematically. And so being able to tell that story and having other people, people in positions of power, look at that and figure out what we can do together to make it right. And also the caring of the land. It's really important to us, too. In Milwaukee, one of the things that is happening is that when a house gets tore down, it gets filled into the land that it's standing on. We want that to stop. It's causing our land to be toxic, and that the land and everything that's in there is affecting our people. And so we have similar concerns, and so I'm glad that we're doing this project together. And I'm hoping that people really listen and listen to not just what it does to the city, but what it does to the people when they're not treated fairly and they don't have access to justice.
Danelle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Neil, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
That's Danelle Cross with Metcalf Park Community Bridges in Milwaukee and Neil Patterson with the State University of New York, both partnering in the Whose Land Project. James Levy, let's bring you in for our last minute or so. We just heard from two of your partners in this project. Leave us with a picture of the road ahead now for the Whose Land Project.
Well, I just love hearing them. I mean, they're what it's about, and all of our partners are. And, you know, the Whose Land Project begins in June. I mean, it's great to be on now and at our kickoff moment. But we are working with students, with faculty, and many different campuses in both states. We're looking at rural and urban connections. This is part of the story of dispossession. There's dispossession in rural areas and dispossession in urban areas, as you just heard. But there's also the urbanization process itself is part of the story. And then we're working with community partners, and all of them are going to together, all of us are going to be identifying stories, identifying people to interview, going into archives, going into land deed offices, and doing research and field work this summer and fall. And so this project is an 18-month project, and we're going to be launching some of what we do, like the podcast, not until summer and fall of 2022. But in the meantime, this is very public. So we want anyone who wants to get involved, you know, there will be moments where we will share our research findings. There'll be these community gathering days where people can bring photographs and family, you know, collections and stories to us in either state. So we're really excited to get started. And I'm really grateful for this opportunity to talk about it, Rob.
Well, we'll talk to you again in a year and a half or so, James. Thanks so much for joining us today.
All right. Thank you.
That's James Levy, Associate Professor of History at UW-Whitewater. We've been talking about this project, just kicking off the Whose Land Project. Coming up after the news, it's Food Friday. We'll talk about edible flowers. I'm Rob Barrett. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up Monday at 7 on the morning show, it's the State Capitol Report with a look at a proposed state law that would require the playing of the national anthem at many sporting events in Wisconsin. That's Monday morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, things are starting to grow and bloom a lot here in Wisconsin, and our next guest says some flowers aren't just for looking at, they're also good for eating, too. We're talking about edible flowers on this week's edition of Food Friday. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever had an edible flower? What did you think of it? Do you use flowers in your cooking, on your dishes? Do you grow them with the intention of eating them? Do you have questions for our guest about how to use flowers in our food? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Scott Williams is the owner of Garden to Be, a small vegetable, herb, and flower farm near Mount Horeb. He regularly sells and delivers to restaurants and grocery stores in Wisconsin. Scott, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, hi there, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, I think, Scott, a lot of people will go into herb growing and vegetable gardening. Not everybody goes into edible flowers. What first got you into growing and consuming flowers?
When I started out in the farm, we were selling to in all different directions, farmers markets, and we started a CSA. And I really, really enjoyed working with chefs right away. It immediately just struck a beautiful chord in my soul. And I love working with chefs that are artists and scientists. And, you know, I met some early on that enjoyed, using edible flowers and asked me to grow some. And I just started there and did a lot, just started doing a lot of different varieties, and it's grown over time.
And we should have the note of caution here. I should not just start wandering around eating flowers at random, right? No. I've got to pick the ones that people already know are edible.
Well, yeah, there's that. Some really aren't good for you. Some are somewhat toxic. Plus that, you know, you don't know if you're not the one growing them, you don't know if they've been sprayed. I mean, not all sprays just wash right off, and edible flowers, a lot of flowers aren't ones that you typically wash. They're so delicate. So I would recommend not eating any that you find or aren't provided by a chef at a restaurant you're at, or that you're not growing yourself.
All right. Now we've got that out of the way. What are some of the coolest things you've seen chefs, Scott, do with the flowers you've grown?
I should start. I mean, I've been doing this for, you know, over 20 years, and I'm going to start with one that is current right now. It's, I think you used the photo, on the website to promote today's show. And, a friend of mine, chef, Jamie Hong at her restaurant, Ahan, here in Madison, she took some of the viola flowers that I'm growing and rolled them into a summer roll. And it uses a almost transparent, rice paper roll around the outside. And they're just gorgeous. It's really, really beautiful. It's fun to eat. So that right away stands out to me. I like them when they garnish drinks. I think that's a fun way to use them. Boy, I don't know. A classic is the stuffed squash blossom. It's Italian, just classic. I love that fried, that little bit of egg and breadcrumb on the outside with the cheese stuffed inside. That one's been around forever, and I like that one too. I don't know. It's hard to say. It's
like you've seen a lot at this point.
I have.
Now let's talk more about those violas. I understand they're not too hard to grow. Like, this is something that people could plausibly be planting over the next week or two, right, and get some edible flowers out of this season.
Yeah, sure. Violas, pansies, that family, they grow a long time. They flower for a long time. And they don't take up a lot of space in your garden. You can grow them in pots, in windows, and they're fairly easy to maintain. They're just beautiful. And once they start blossoming, if you pick them off now and again, you know, just clean up the plant, pick off the older ones, they'll continue to blossom for months and months.
We are talking about edible flowers on this week's edition of Food Friday. Scott Williams is with us from Garden to Be, a vegetable, herb, and flower farm near Mount Horeb. He supplies, among other things, edible flowers to restaurants in the area. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about edible flowers? Do you grow flowers to be eaten? 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's go right to your calls now. Lisa is with us in Madison. Lisa, hi.
Hi. Edible flowers are great for drinks, too. Just a couple of days ago, I made a simple syrup, some sugar and water, and I poured them over some lilacs and blackberries to steep for a couple of hours. Press that out, add that with some lemon juice to a good gin and a good tonic water, and you have a delicious gin and tonic.
Ooh, okay. I like the sounds of that. Any other drinks you like to use that your flower flavors in, Lisa?
I'm a gin and tonic, and when I live in England, you got to use Fever Tree tonic water. So they sell it in the U.S. now. So, yeah, gin and tonics are my thing.
Lisa, thanks. Gin and tonic connoisseur plus the flowers. So making a simple syrup with some of our flowers, Scott, is that something you've encountered?
Not one that I've done, no. I can imagine some of the chefs doing that, and not one that I've done here at home. I have to admit, I take a pretty simple approach. I like them raw. We garnish, we make some of our standard meals just a little bit more prettier by adding them. I like a nasturtium in a Bloody Mary. It's got that similar kind of peppery flavor. It's really beautiful up on top. It's just another garnish on a drink that often gets lots of garnishes, but not often flowers.
Lisa, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. We'll go next to Nancy in Ridgeland. Nancy, hi.
Well, good afternoon. I've already learned something, and I just was really glad now that I bought some violas the other day, because now I have five little plants and I've got a new use for them in addition to just being pretty. But I was also going to mention the nasturtiums on salads because of that peppery flavor that you just mentioned. And also something to spice up some lemonade just to make it really pretty is to get some clear, nice clear glasses and put a violet blossom in every ice cube that you put in your lemonade in the summer. And that's really, it's pretty and fun.
Awesome, Nancy. I love it. Thank you so much for sharing that. Now, her note about nasturtiums in salad, Scott, I imagine that salads are a real go-to. As you mentioned, you like the flowers fresh, so they're going to add a great visual appeal to salads and some unique flavor.
Yeah. Nancy brings up a good point. Some of the flowers really do have distinct flavors. The nasturtium we both mentioned is one. You know, marigolds, there's, you know, a whole series of tiny marigolds called the Gem series, which are very citrusy in flavor. Those are all flowers that the flavor will stand out even over your greens and your dressings. And that's great. In addition to making it pretty, you get a real distinct flavor with them too.
Awesome, Nancy. Thank you so much for sharing that. I love the idea of the ice cubes with some flowers inside them too. Francisco joins us next in Sister Bay. Francisco, hi.
Yes, I'm an authentic Mexican. And I was born in Mexico, and the Mexicans survived the year because they eat weeds when they're tender, and they eat another vegetable called verdolaga, and that extends all about 20 feet up from the center, and we pick it up, and then we eat tunas, which comes from the cactus. And then they give you a lot of value in your digestive tract. For example, the tunas you eat, and also the seeds, and all of that doesn't cost you a penny because it's wild. And
Francisco,
in Mexico, the land belongs to everybody.
Francisco, thank you so much for sharing that. Some of the plants, I'm guessing a lot of the plants that grow wild in Mexico, we're not going to see around here that much, Scott. But that said, are there wildflowers in Wisconsin that you know of that are good to eat?
Well, violets, those real low-growing plants, grow through the woods around the farm here. And they have a really pretty five-petal, kind of sharp, spiky blue or purple flower. Definitely grown those, I've harvested and used those. I'm trying to think of indigenous plants where we're eating the flowers. Now I'm drawing a blank. You stumped me.
Sorry about that, Francisco.
No, it's good. It's exciting.
Future research. Yeah, Francisco, thanks for that call. Let's go to Lila next in Crawford County. Lila, hello.
Hi. I wanted to mention a wildflower that's blooming now, the violet, he just mentioned it. Mm-hmm. As a great follow-up to Francisco, he introduced me very nicely. I just came in from the garden where I was pulling violets as weeds because I didn't want them to compete with the peas in the garden. And they're really blooming nicely right now, and I love to put them in my salads. They're delicious and highly nutritious, very high in iron and vitamin C. And I have not only the purple violets, but I've also got white ones growing here.
Interesting. Wow. Lila, thank you so much for sharing that. Now, Scott, she mentioned picking them, you know, they're weeds in effect in her garden, but they're nice to eat. Are violets something you grow on purpose for your garden to be?
I don't. They grow pretty abundantly here, especially along the edges of the from the yard and fields and into the woods. They grow prolifically. So I haven't planted any specifically, just because I come by them pretty easily. But Lila did make me think of something else too, which is that a lot of vegetables have flowers that are edible. And, you know, sometimes you might get to the point where you're not ready to eat any more zucchini, for instance, and you can harvest blossoms and eat those for a little bit. You're going to take away the opportunity for that flower to turn into a fruit. But if you've already had your fill of zucchinis, you can eat that. And beans are another one. I grow pole beans, runner beans, and those little bean blossoms are crunchy and delicious and really pretty as well.
Thanks again for the call, Lila. It's Food Friday. We're talking about using flowers in our cooking. Scott Williams is with us. He's owner, operator, and farmer behind Garden to Be, a small farm near Mount Horeb. Among other things, he grows edible flowers that are used in many restaurants in the area. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you eat flowers? Do you have a favorite? What do you do with them? Salads, cooking, drinks? Tell us about it. Do you have questions for our guest about eating and or growing edible flowers? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our Food Friday conversation about edible flowers with Scott Williams. He's owner of Garden to Be, a small farm near Mount Horeb that grows edible flowers. You could join in with your thoughts, experiences, and or questions about using flowers in your food at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Back to your calls now. Jacob is with us in Madison. Jacob, hi.
Hi. There's a large array of things people can use, like herb flowers, like oregano and thyme, things like that, apple blossoms, anything in the carnation family, which includes the little pinks and dianthus. But I thought it was really important to let people know, when you mentioned vegetables, that anything in the potato, tomato, eggplant family, those are all nightshades, and you don't want to eat those. So don't just eat any vegetable flower.
Jacob, thanks a lot for the note, and that gets back to our point, Scott, earlier with flowers. Know before you try eating them that they are edible and not toxic.
Right.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, there's beans and peas, the ones that produce fruit that we eat are safe and can be tasty. But the floral sweet peas that are grown for small vases, those actually are toxic. So, you do have to really pay attention and look it up before you go in.
But Jacob also mentioned something that I just learned today poking around. If I'm growing herbs and they start to flower, I'm like, oh, I blew it. They're flowering. It's too late. But we could eat the flowers from some of our herbs?
Yeah, so some herbs you kind of want to flower before you use them, like Thai basil frequently is used with a little bit of flower on it. But I actually grow a pineapple sage that I don't use the herb itself. I don't use the leaves or anything really at all, but I love the flowers. They have this very long, narrow trumpet-like, a bright red flower. And when you pull it, if you can actually suck just a tiny bit of nectar out of it, it's pineapple juice in the flower. That one's really great to add to a salad.
That sounds great. Let's go back. Thanks, Jacob, for calling in. Let's go to Esther now in Deer Park. Esther, hi.
Yes, good afternoon. I had a question about fruit trees, and a previous caller mentioned apple trees, but I also wanted to know if you ate the whole flower of the blossom of the apple or the fruit tree, or if you picked off just the petals.
Hey, that's interesting, that's Scott, you know?
Yeah, that's a great question. So you can eat the whole blossom like that, but that shouldn't stop you from sometimes pulling out the petals. In fact, one of my most popular items, of flower items for sale is something I call a confetti, and I will take a lot of flowers and just gently remove petals from a just vast array of types and colors and make a confetti. And that would be another great thing to do with apple blossoms, but you can eat that whole little bud.
All right. Thanks, Esther. Let's go to Michelle now in Osseo. Michelle, hello.
Hello.
What do you want to tell us about, Michelle?
Well, we were just talking about herbs. I like to use chive blossoms in my salads. And I like to put them in white wine vinegar for a few weeks, and it turns it into a beautiful pink vinegar for good for all year long with the chives or the garlic chive flavor.
Wow. Thanks, Michelle. I've had chives growing in my front yard for years, and I eat the chives. I didn't know I could eat the chive blossoms, Scott.
Yeah, and you can't stop the blossom from happening. It's going to happen here, you know, late spring, and that is an excellent suggestion. I love that with the vinegar. It's great for dressings and stuff.
That sounds really good. Thank you so much for that call. It's Food Friday. We're talking to Scott Williams from Garden to Bee, and we're talking about eating flowers, edible flowers, that is, and using them in our food. Still time for your favorites at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Linda is with us in Milwaukee. Linda, hi.
Hi. I've been harvesting violets from my lawn and my garden and made about 3 dozen jars of violet jelly.
Violet jelly. Now, give us a taste, Linda. What does it taste like?
It's a very subtle taste. It's slightly floral. I don't think the violets themselves have much of a flavor, but you steep it. You pour boiling water on, you steep them. Then you drain them and use just the liquid like you would any kind of fruit jelly that you make. You add some lemon juice. It changes the color from a deep purple to a nice fuchsia pink. And I use honey and low sugar pectin instead of using sugar. And it's a nice, subtle flavor.
That sounds fantastic, Linda. Thank you so much for sharing that. Scott, I know you like it fresh, but have you heard of this making jelly with violets and other flowers?
That one actually is new to me. What a great idea. Wow. That's cool. I haven't seen that one.
That is fantastic. Thanks again for the call, Linda. We heard a little while ago from Dawn in Middleton who wanted to know what kind of fresh flowers can be steeped to make tea. Any suggestions, Scott?
We heard earlier the lilac blossoms. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think. That's another one that I don't do, and I'm just trying to look. Chamomile, the flowers, what's used to make those teas, rose hips. I'm sure there's dozens more.
A while back, we had a Food Friday conversation with a woman from England who was big on making teas. I will refer our caller back to that conversation. There was a little list there. Let's go back to your calls now. Jeff is with us in Toma. Jeff, hi.
Hi. No, when I was young, I grew up on a farm, and we always had clover and alfalfa, and we could, we didn't always have a lot of money for candy bars or anything, but if you pick those clover blossoms and just bite off the bottom or the bottoms of those, there was just a load of sugar in there and just made us happy every time.
That sounds fantastic. Thank you so much for sharing that story. Clover blossoms, Scott, have you worked with that?
Yeah, well, it's something that I've used as a cover crop on the farm and in pathways, some of the lower growings. But yeah, I have tasted that same thing. It's a great little snack when you're walking.
Time for one more quick call. Angela is with us in Milwaukee. Angela, hi.
Hi. So I just wanted to share two kind of unconventional ones I use both roses and dandelions. So roses, you probably heard of rose water. They use a lot in cosmetics, but I like to use it to kind of flavor cocktails or to put in lemonade to give it kind of a nice herbal flavor. And then for dandelions, I was actually talking with a friend last year who mentioned a dandelion wine that his grandma used to make. So he handed off the recipe to me, and I'm going to try it.
Fantastic. Angela, thanks for the call. And Scott, we'll give Angela the last word. Scott, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Rob. Thank you.
Lots of fun. That was Scott Williams, owner and operator of Garden to Bee, a vegetable, herb, and flower farm near Mount Horeb. He joined us on Food Friday to talk about edible flowers. Coming up Monday on Central Time, a historic lodge in northern Wisconsin is being torn down. We'll look back at the heyday of the Telemark Resort. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. Some surveys tackle the big issues that could shape the future of our nation. Some go another direction, like a poll out this week from the firm YouGov. The question, which of the following animals, if any, do you think you could beat in a fight if you were unarmed? Before we get to the results, here's our standard disclaimer. Central Time does not endorse or encourage the practice of picking fights with any member of the animal or plant kingdoms. You want to fight a fungus? Go for it. Okay, which animals do Americans think they can beat up? At the low end, grizzly bear, lion, elephant, and gorilla. Under 10% of Americans think they could win any of those fights unarmed. But at least 5% on each of those say, yeah, they could win that fight. Gotta admire the confidence, I guess. At the opposite end, rats and house cats are the most easily defeated animals, or at least we think they are. There are some interesting divisions between men and women on the survey, not for the most dangerous animals. Men and women, about the same on those. The biggest gender gaps, medium-sized dog, 60% of men say they'd win that fight, only 39% of women. And goose, a full 71% of men say they could take on a goose compared to just 51% of women. This means something. I don't know what. Eagle, men at 38%, women at 23%. I don't even know how that's going to work. The lesson, A, don't fight animals even if you think you can win, and B, don't write surveys under the influence of mind-altering substances. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.